Let the reader, in order to grasp the implications of this esoteric doctrine, conceive himself as having, in addition to his physical body, which is built of the matter of the first plane and responds to its conditions, an organized system of instincts and the passions to which they give rise. Let him also conceive himself, by means of the sympathetic induction of passion in himself, a common phenomenon, as able to perceive the passions of others. Then let him call this aspect of his nature his psychic or passional body, and conceive of it as functioning upon the second or lower astral plane. Let him then conceive of his emotional nature as similarly organized and related to its own plane of existence, likewise his reasoning faculties and power of abstract thought, finally, his spiritual nature and that ultimate spark of divine life which forms the nucleus about which his individualized existence is built up. Thus it will be realized that man has, as it were, seven different aspects to his nature, and that each of these aspects is referred to as a body by esoteric science. The monad, in the course of its evolution, is conceived of as gathering about itself the matter of each plane, but long ages of experience and development are required before the masses of matter concerned become organized into definite bodies capable of functioning both subjectively and objectively. In other words, ages pass before the forming bodies are sufficiently evolved to carry on the functions of their respective states of existence, and to be aware of external conditions on their own planes of manifestation. The physical body both functions and is aware of its environment by means of direct consciousness, but in the average man this is the only body that has as yet obtained its dual development. In him, however, the second, third, and very often, in civilized races, the fourth plane bodies are sufficiently developed to be capable of functioning subjectively, but it is not common to find a fifth plane body developed, carrying with it the power of abstract thought, and still rarer is it to find a true development of the spiritual nature, as distinguished from emotional ideals appertaining to the third plane, which are often mistaken for true spirituality. In a more evolved type of man, however, we may get a development of one or more of the subtler bodies which enable them to perceive their environment, by means of direct consciousness, in contrast to subconscious impressions, as is the case in the unevolved man. Thus, instead of merely being influenced subconsciously by the emotional states of his fellows, AU without knowing what is the matter with him, as is usually the case, the evolved man is fully conscious of the feelings of his companions. Evolution is steadily developing the subtler bodies, as is proved by the fact that what is called psychism is increasingly common in its minor manifestations. It is a little understood fact concerning man's nature that, although a synthesis of all the states of consciousness is the highest form of existence, it is possible, by concentrating upon any one state of consciousness, to limit intention to that state alone, and by this means to perceive, as a world of its own, that plane of manifestation to which it corresponds. When he does this, a man is said to be AU functioning in his astral body upon the third plane or in his concrete mind upon the fourth, and while he is so engaged, the physical form, owing to the detachment of consciousness from its nervous system, is found to be in a state of trance. Those who have the necessary knowledge deliberately entrance themselves in order to obtain extension of consciousness upon planes which they are otherwise unable to contact in the stage of development to which they have attained, but it is little realized the extent to which this expansion of consciousness takes place involuntarily in sleep among persons who have evolved a little beyond the average. The true aim of evolution, however, is not to segregate consciousness, but to correlate it. And the trance method of transcending physical consciousness is merely a temporary expedient. Chapter 8, Evolution and Initiation. It will be seen that esoteric science conceives of man as evolving from the subhuman to the human and then on to the superhuman, to the states of consciousness of the psychic, the inspired, and the illuminated. The great tide of evolution will take even the most debased on to the heights of spirit in the course of time, but as great a length of time must elapse for the consummation of this process as has already served to bring man to his present state of development. There is, however, a method of quickening evolution which is known as initiation, where through the deliberate use of his reason and his will a man can do for himself rapidly what evolution is doing slowly for all existence. It is held that life did not issue forth simultaneously from the great unmanifest, but rather in a stream or procession, so that, although all go by the same path, some are ahead of others, and therefore each high states of development while their brethren are either awaiting manifestation or are at low degrees of evolution. These elder brethren, whether still in the flesh or advanced beyond the stage whereat a physical body is warm, may, if actuated by the same philanthropy which makes us care for the weak and ignorant upon the physical plane, instruct and help those who are worthy of, and capable of benefiting by, such assistance. Many of such individuals have already been trained by the elder brethren, and these disciples form the vanguards of evolution. They, in their turn, instruct others who are their successors, so that evolution may be compared to a flight of wild duck in which the strongest take the tremendous air pressure at the apex of the wedge and the weaker spread out behind. If a man's moral, intellectual, and spiritual natures are well developed, or, to use the esoteric terminology, if his subtler bodies are becoming organized, then he may be chosen by the elder brethren for special training. Instruction will first be conveyed telepathically to his subconscious mind, and, when he has progressed sufficiently far in this way, he will be placed in contact with pupils of the elder brethren upon the physical plane, who will teach and train him consciously by the ordinary means of that plane, the spoken and written word. Then, when he has made further progress, the elder and younger brethren together, by means of the process known as initiation, correlate subconsciousness with consciousness. The reader, at this point, may ask how this contact with the masters can be made. Little can be said upon this point, for it is a matter of inner experience. It suffices to say that the desire, if strong enough and maintained long enough, will pierce the veil and effect the contact desired. Thereafter the path opens up as the pupil advances. Chapter 9. The Esoteric Concept of Sex. To understand the esoteric philosopher's concept of sex, we have to remember that the world as known to him is seven times as complex as that known to the exoteric philosopher, for to the former the physical world is but one of seven planes of manifestation, the physical phenomena known to us as sex form but one aspect of a force that functions upon all these seven planes. Even exoteric science is beginning to recognize that sex has an emotional as well as a physical aspect. Esoteric science declares that it has mental and spiritual aspects in addition to those under which it is usually recognized, and that upon each plane it expresses itself differently, functioning according to the laws of that plane, for all the elements of sex found on the seven planes, blent in right proportions, are essential to the highest kind of sex life. Moreover, it is on the subtler planes that the sex forces originate and are controlled. It is only by understanding the manifestations of sex and the laws that govern them upon these planes that we can hope to control their action in ourselves and society. The esotericist does not use the term asexo as we do. He speaks of alif forcia, which he conceives to be an energy of an electro-hydraulic type, a radiating and magnetizing vibratory activity, similar to electricity, to which it is very closely related, yet capable of compression and of exercising pressure after the type of water power. This force he conceives to radiate from the great first cause, and therefore to be divine in its nature, expressing itself through the vehicles which the monads have built upon the different planes, and therefore conditioned by the nature of the plane on which it works, and further limited by the type and imperfections of each individual vehicle, so that, although the life force may undergo many transmutations and even be put to uses far removed from its original impulse, it is nevertheless divine in origin and nature, to be revered as sacred, and to be held by the individual through whom it is functioning as a sacred trust which he has to administer under the direction of the divine life itself, with the entire species of which he is a member as beneficiary. This life force maintains in existence all that is, and preserves living forms from the disintegrating forces that constantly seek to reduce all specialized substance to its common root. This is the first function of the life force, to maintain in manifestation that which has achieved a form, and to hold it at the level to which it has evolved. When functioning thus, it is known as life the preserver, and is conceived of as a unity. It is a second task, however, in the creation of new forms, and for this it has to function in polarity as a duality with a positive and negative aspect, and it is to this phase of life activity that the exoteric concept of sex is related. For the maintenance of life, a single force is sufficient, but for any form of creation, two forces are necessary, one of which shall be actual and one inertly potential, that is to say, the first force shall be a velocity and the second shall be a force locked up in form which shall be set free by the stimulus of the velocity. We have, then, in these two forces, one that is seeking to expend itself and so arrive at a state of equilibrium, and the other that is inert, potential, and awaiting a stimulus. The latter or female force may be compared to a charge of dynamite in whose particles chemical energy is stored up, latent, and the former or male force to the electric shock, or blow of a hammer, which releases that latent energy. These two forces are spoken of by the esotericist as being positive and negative, male and female, the positive or male force being the stimulator, and the negative or female force, by means of latent energy, performing the actual work of creation under the influence of the male or stimulator, and immediately becoming impotent when the impulse of his stimulation is withdrawn. Wherever such action or reaction is at work, the esotericist considers the relationship of sexes present, whether in the mineral kingdom or the world of mind. Chapter 10. The esoteric concept of male and female. It was said by one who knew that in the kingdom of heaven there is neither marrying nor giving in marriage. This is erroneously supposed to mean that the spiritual man is sexless. Esoteric science, however, conceives him not to be sexless, but on the contrary, bisexual, and therefore complete in himself. The individuality is two-sided, positive and negative, has a kinetic aspect and a static aspect, and is therefore male-female or female-male, according to the relation of a forcia to a former in its makeup. The personality, however, is one-sided, and therefore has a defined sex. The individuality may be thought of as a magnet, having a positive and a negative pole, one of which at a time is inserted in dense matter, and the nature of the pole inserted determines the sex of the body that is built up around it. The individuality, whose life is an evolution, has both aspects to its nature, but the personality, whose life is an incarnation, has but one aspect in function, the other being latent or undeveloped. This is well illustrated in the bee, wherein the manner of feeding determines whether sex shall be developed or not, and also in the human form, wherein the characteristic organs of the other sex are always present in rudimentary form, and may even, in certain types of abnormality, attain considerable development if not actual function. While sex is strictly determined on the physical plane by structural form, on the subtler planes it depends upon relative force, which is constantly varying, so that two people who are male and female on the physical plane may be constantly shifting their polarity in their relations on the inner planes. Thus, should they be dealing with a matter in which the man is preeminent, he will lead and she will follow, but should conditions change and the pair be working in a sphere in which she is preeminent, then the polarity will shift and the woman will assume the mastery. Witness the exceeding meekness of a man when a baby is thrust into his arms. The one who feels the deepest will be male on the plane of the emotions, and the one who knows the most will be male on the plane of the mind, regardless of the body in which each happens to be incarnated. As, however, the male body is better fitted for the expression of a positive type of force, the man will generally be male on the subtler planes as well as the denser. But if there is any considerable inequality of force, then the woman may be relatively male to her mate upon the inner planes. It must never be forgotten that maleness and femaleness are always relative upon the inner planes, and as the physical vigor of the individuals of a pair shifts about, so will the relative sexuality shift with it, and a man may be pure male in his relations with one woman, and pure female, or negative, in his relations with another. Form determines the sex of the individual on the physical plane, but relative force determines it on the inner planes, and this fact is the clue to much. Chapter 11. the interaction between positive and negative upon the non-physical planes. A. The spiritual planes. Upon the seventh plane AO or LA one and one is all. A. This is an oft-repeated axiom of esoteric philosophy. Upon this plane exist entities of two types, those that have as yet progressed but little beyond their origin, and are upon the downward or outgoing curve of evolution, and those who, having completed their evolution, have risen up to the level of their source. This plane, we are told, is entirely formless. Entities of the former type have not yet achieved form, while those of the second, having learned all that form can teach them, have cast it aside, together with its limitations, and attained to perfect freedom within the limits of the universe to which they belong. All are one upon this plane, we are told. The relationship existing between each unit and the rest of the plane far exceeds in intimacy and completeness the highest that is ever attained by earthly lovers in their most ecstatic moments of union. This state is the permanent, normal condition of the seventh plane, which may well be called the kingdom of heaven, for it is a state of perfect love and perfect harmony. Human lovers fear that they may lose each other in what they conceive to be a vacant formless nirvana. On the contrary, the perfection of union, which has hitherto only been possible at rare moments between rare persons, that becomes the normal state of the whole creation. Upon the seventh plane, and upon the seventh plane only, there is no differentiation into positive and negative force. This plane has sometimes been called the plane of pure pressure. Upon the sixth plane occurs the first differentiation, or beginning of separateness. The universal pressure of the seventh plane causes force to flow forth in all directions, and the streams diverge as they proceed. These streams are called, in esoteric terminology, the rays, and each ray is conceived to be a special aspect of the divine nature. Each monad, as it comes into being upon the sixth plane, is found to have issued into manifestation through one ray or another, and this primal environment determines the type of the monad forever after. It will work with the forces of other rays, but the color tone of its own ray will form the keynote of its nature, and by the gate through which it issued forth must it return when its cycle of evolution is completed. It is well known that for electricity to become active it must flow in a circuit. The man who is completely insulated from all earth contacts can touch a live wire with impunity, because he offers no channel for its force. So it is with the life force. It flows into each monad from the divine source, and, having passed through that monad and energized it, flows forth into circumambient space. Then, having made a circuit which is only bounded by the limits of the manifested universe, and in the course of this circuit been reduced to its lowest form of manifestation, it is finally reabsorbed by the divine as unorganized cosmic force. If, however, it is desired to perform any work with this force, it must not be allowed to radiate into space and so become unavailable. It must be concentrated into a definite channel, and, by being limited and defined, be converted into pressure and thus made a source of energy. This is achieved by causing it to flow and return in the channel of individualized form. In the path of outgoing it makes its own channel through each and all of the individualized monads then in existence, but a path of return for it has to be made if its wasteful diffusion is to be prevented. The knowledge of the methods of making this path of returning is one of the secrets of practical occultism. The methods of achieving this flow and return are, in principle, the same upon all the planes, but the exact device employed differs according to the matter in which it is being carried out. In essence it is this: a monad of a type inclined to press forward into manifestation or individualization cooperates with a monad of a type inclined to press forward towards union with the divine, towards a universalization. If these two can meet together and form a continuity of substance, the life force that is flowing out from the divine through the positive or male individual, instead of radiating into free space after its work in the machine of his organism has been accomplished, will flow back to the divine through the negative or female individual. At the point of junction between the two units, the force can be tapped and rendered available for creation in the matter of the plane upon which the union is being effected. This is the essence of the esoteric teaching concerning the sex function. this device of cosmic sex, or polarity, if that word be preferred owing to the associations of the other, is resorted to upon the sixth plane. Firstly, in order to induce a strong flow of force from the seventh into a sixth plane form, and secondly, in order to maintain this force upon a high level and avoid the degradation and diffusion it would undergo if allowed to follow its normal course, run down the planes, and diffuse into cosmic space before returning to the divine. An example will assist to make this clear. Let us take the case of a man of lofty spiritual character who feels himself called to a spiritual mission of regeneration to mankind. In the parlance of esoteric science, it would be said that such a man, in order to be a channel for lofty spiritual forces, must have his sixth plane body highly developed, because he is working with the forces of that plane and they can only achieve adequate expression through a highly organized vehicle. If that man is content to remain a solitary devotee, he may raise his own life to a very high degree of evolution by communing with the divine life, but he will make no mark on his race and age. The outside world will be uninfluenced by him. Should he, however, choose to perform work in the outside world, to influence the spiritual life of his fellows, it will be observed that he immediately gathers about himself a little group of disciples who stand in a different relation to him than do the rank and file of his followers. To his followers he gives, and neither asks nor receives any return, but on his disciples he depends in some peculiar and intimate way but little understood by the outside world. Though they are of lesser spiritual stature than himself, he yet leans upon them and is deeply affected by any defection on their part. These disciples may be male or female, it matters not. All that is required of them is that they should be in intimate sympathetic union with their master, and of a degree of spiritual development, approximating to his own, and then it will be seen that the little group functions as a unit at the core of the spiritual movement. Furthermore, should missionaries be sent out to spread the master's teaching, it will be observed that they are sent in pairs in order that they may assist each other. Now, in this interaction between a strong positive nature, which acts as channel for a powerful spiritualizing force, and less vigorous, relatively negative natures which receive this force, the esoteric scientist would see the divine life force functioning in polarity. A curious confirmation of this statement will be seen in a phenomenon which not infrequently occurs in connection with the invocation of spiritual forces. Many a religious teacher founders upon the rock of sensuality, and those who succeed in steering the bark of life safely through the narrow strait of righteousness have left record in their autobiographies of terrible struggle, before the victory was won. They were tempted of the devil to an extent which is spared the ordinary mortal. Their sensual nature, to judge from the visions and thoughts they record as assailing them, must have been as strong as their spiritual nature, and it was only by an extreme asceticism that it was kept under control. Hence mortification of the flesh, and the avoidance of all possible stimulation of fleshly desires, is a sine qua non of the higher forms of religious devotion. Some psychologists see in this well-known phenomenon another proof that sex is at the root of all things, and regard the religious feelings as sublimations of the sexual ones, thinking that they have disposed once and for all of the spiritual life by proving its connection with the sexual life. The esotericist, however, views this phenomenon from a different standpoint. He believes both sets of activities to be the manifestation of one and the same force, a pure divine force of the utmost sacredness, and that the form which this force takes is determined by the machine through which it functions, so that, should this force be run through the vehicle of the sixth plane body, it will manifest itself as spiritual fervor and dynamic power, and will act upon the spiritual natures of those with whom it comes in contact, whereas, should it be run through the mental body, it will be creative intellect, and if through the physical body, sex force in the ordinary sense of the term. Yet he holds that, wherever it runs, it is one and the same force, and that its final manifestation in procreation does not in any way degrade it, but that a force primarily spiritual being employed in procreation makes procreation itself a divine and sacred act. Popular thought, however, and especially theological thought, frightened by the well-known phenomenon of the sensuality of the mystic, does not regard the life force when manifested upon the physical plane as in any way a sacred thing, but rather as a manifestation of the lower side of our nature at war against our spiritual self. But there are some confessors, wise in human nature, who are shrewd enough to see it as different aspects of one and the same thing. When sensuality brings a religious teacher into disrepute, it is usually considered that man's life, as a spiritual force, is necessarily over, and this may, indeed, be the case, for should the great forces he was handling have so slipped from his control as to come down to the physical level, he will find it very hard, after such a cloudburst, to gather them back again into their appointed channel. His embankments may have been swept away, and he may never again be capable of the concentration of energy whereby work is effected. But all the same, it was a spiritual force that broke bounds, and not a force of the underworld. The tremendous cosmic energy which that man had caused to flow through the channel of his individualized self proved of greater voltage, metaphorically speaking, than he could carry, and so his spiritual nature fused under the strain and short-circuited. The current was literally earthed. Instead of the strongly organized spiritual nature keeping the current within its appointed channel and handing it on to the spiritual side of others, so that it should flow back to its divine source without once leaving the sixth plane, the pressure upon that man's spiritual body was so great that the force got out of hand and followed the line of least resistance, the line of the natural evolutionary flow, from the seventh plane down to the first, and then back again via the earth's soul. And he was as little culpable as is the man whose milldam gives way and swamps a village. True, he ought to have known that the head of water was too great for the strength of his embankments, but he is not the deliberate murderer of that village. This is a phenomenon well known to the esoteric scientist, the bursting of a spiritual milldam under pressures too high for the organism to withstand, and the degradation of divine forces to the lowest planes of existence. What, it may be asked, is the remedy for this? Firstly, prevention is better than cure, and all subtle forces should be carefully regulated to the moral stamina of the person employing them. Secondly, solitary work should be avoided so that other eyes may be able to see the first crack in the milldam, a thing of which the owner thereof would be the last one to become aware. Then, should such a warning of collapse appear, the menaced individual should stop all inner activities and turn out onto the material plane in vigorous bodily exercise, or even mortification of the good old-fashioned type. Above all, he should refrain from invoking any more spiritual power till the channels for its passage have been repaired. For the mystic to invite further ecstasies under such conditions is to induce either an outbreak of sensuality or an outbreak of hysteria, and the intuitions of many spiritual souls were sound when they felt that under such circumstances they were unworthy to approach their God, but must work humbly in the fields, or tending the poor, till they had rendered themselves worthy recipients of his favors and he deigned to approach them again. Such spiritual humility should save many a would-be saint from shame. When the life forces are upon the lower planes, we open up the higher planes at our peril. B. The mental planes. The action of polarity can be clearly traced in the two aspects of mind functioning as abstract and concrete thought. Upon the fifth plane, or plane of abstract thought, the great rays that represent the activities of the sixth plane are further elaborated into qualities and abstract principles. Being entirely abstract, this plane can only be conceived of with the help of similes, and its nature can be no more than indicated in a book of the present type. A practical illustration may assist, however, in showing the nature of the activities of this plane. There are two types of logical thought. In the first or deductive type, from a general principle, particular instances of its operation are inferred, and in the second or inductive type of reasoning, a general law is inferred from particular instances. While everybody makes use of both these methods in mental work, it will be found that one or other type predominates in the logical thought of each individual sufficiently evolved to make use of this plane of mentation. The great bulk of humanity, as can be readily observed, have not reached this state of evolution, but proceed by the rule of thumb method, depending upon memory for guidance, and unable to draw more than the most obvious conclusions from experience.